I've been in the program space mm-hmm. since I've started my career. And so I've never been in the fundraising space. So this was definitely like a learning experience. From the beginning, I just mass applied to a ton of grants. And I know that's like not the best way to do it, because people say relationships is what matters, but I didn't have any relationships or connections with mm-hmm. any funders or organizations. So what I would do is I would look at other organizations in the space, pull up their tax documents, see who had donated to them, and then see if they accepted unsolicited proposals. And then I would send in a proposal, and I would do one a day. And then it took a year before we got our first yes. And that was like a really exciting thing for someone to say yes, let's do it.
You're listening to the Communitas of New York podcast, where we invite you, our business-focused listener, to join us in our strategic focus on business development. In our first season, we viewed the constellation of stories generated by Communitas Ventures Accelerator Program alumni creating positive impact in communities in New York. We explore how community-driven founders navigate the challenges of accessing the right resources at the right time, how they stay true to their respective missions, and how they best manage their potential. We welcome you as we hear tales of trials and successes, as well as valuable advice from our interviewee entrepreneurs. I'm your host, Monique T. Marshall. This is episode 6 with Vicky Garolina of Inspiring Futures.
Vicky, welcome to Communitas of New York. It is a treat to have you on the show, so welcome.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here.
We're happy to have you on the show. Before we dive into this amazing conversation that we have planned for today, I would love it if you could share a little bit about who you are, what are you doing at Inspiring Futures, and what really inspired you to start your company?
Sure. My name is Vicky Garolina. I'm the founder and executive director of a nonprofit organization named Inspiring Futures. We provide free mental health services and academic support to any young adults who've been in foster care, adopted, unaccompanied minors, or have experienced youth homelessness. Our goal is to improve the high school and college graduation rates for these young people. And what inspired me to start is my own experience in the mental health system growing up, and then my experience as a foster mom, seeing the kids that have been in my home and the things that they've been through. And then seeing the stark statistics of the low graduation rates for these youth, and then working for a ton of nonprofits in the past over a decade, seeing a lot of the bureaucracy mm-hmm. and wanting to just put different things together and see how we could make an impact as well.
I love it. I love that you shared that part of your story and the fact that you have that experience. And another thing that I found is also at Inspiring Futures, your staff also has an experience with this situation or with this community as well. Can you kind of talk more about how you've been able to also align your team with the work that you are doing in Inspiring Futures and kind of how their background relates as well?
Yes, absolutely. We all have either lived experience in some level with the child welfare system or shared demographics with the young people. And everyone takes also the 52-hour adoption training through the National Training Institute so that they also have like the professional background in addition to their own education.
Mm-hmm. And I love that. And Vicky, I want to dive a little bit more into the gaps that you kind of mentioned that you were seeing as well, and kind of like talk about that a bit more. And what were you seeing with other programs as maybe you were experiencing these things or saw people close to you? And what made you say, okay, this is the way that Inspiring Futures is going to be different?
Well, I think it's important to note that like I grew up in New York, but then I moved to Los Angeles when I was 18. And mm-hmm. so I spent my whole adult working life in Los Angeles. I moved back to New York probably in early 2020, late 2019. Mm-hmm. And so the systems are very different in both places, the child welfare system and the mental health system. And I've been a foster parent in both of those states. Mm-hmm. And I've been, you know, a practitioner in both of those states as well. And regarding child welfare, New York City has 7,000 young people in foster care about, whereas Los Angeles County has 35,000. And that's mm-hmm. not to say like more or less is better. And I know they want to reduce the door reduce the front door of young people entering the system, but then the supports also are not always available to people who've been touched by the system, but then are no longer in foster care. And so in Los Angeles, anyone can be in foster care and then age out or leave and then sign themselves back in until they're 21. And all they have very extensive like mental health supports that will follow the young people as they go to different placements. They go into the community. They have teams of people that follow them. I had a 13-year-old living with me in Los Angeles. And then she ran away when she was like 16 from a group home. Wow. And then she ended up, when she turned 18, she took a Greyhound to live with me in New York. And she stayed with me for like a year, and Los Angeles reopened her case and had a social worker fly out every month to just make sure she was okay. Yeah. And then provide her with a stipend every month to get her life back on track. Whereas in New York City, the resources are very much a lot of times with the foster care providers themselves, the foster care agencies. And then if a young person is no longer with an open foster care case, they cannot receive those services anymore. And then after they've aged out or they leave the system for any reason, those resources are not available. So our organization, our referrals are through like an open Jot form link. And so anyone can refer themselves or a young person, and they don't need to be currently connected to any agency. And we will be able to serve them even if they move homes or go anywhere throughout New York State. So it's supposed to be more comprehensive or fluid, I would say.
Gotcha. So I love that you laid that out and kind of like showed the differences. And now I want to kind of talk about your experience and your expertise. So you studied psychology and sociology as an undergrad and have a master of social work degree and also a doctor of education. Can you talk about what that process was like in terms of making sure that you were up-leveling your knowledge of this industry and what impact it has made on closing those gaps within this industry?
Sure. So with my master's in social work, I knew that I needed that to be a therapist. And once I was a licensed social worker for several years, it wasn't until I want to say 2019. I had been a foster parent also for a few years as well. And I just saw how much these young people were struggling, even though there was so much support available to them. And so I wanted to kind of investigate that a little bit more. And so I did get my doctorate of education, and my dissertation was on the graduation rates of young people in post-secondary institutions, young people who experience the system. And so nationally, 50% of young people who've been in foster care graduate high school. In Los Angeles County, it's slightly more. It's like 70%, I want to say. But then in New York City, it's only 21%. And so something is going wrong for these young people, especially if they've spent no time in the system at all. They graduate at a rate of like 86% for high school. And so as part of my dissertation, I partnered with some other organizations working in the space, and I did interviews and surveys of young people in college, students that had been in foster care. And I interviewed them. I also interviewed like social workers, foster parents, and I asked like what I wanted it to be strengths-based. Like these were amazing students that were in college despite all odds. Only 3% of young people who've been in foster care graduate college. So it was like, what worked for them and what were the barriers? Mm-hmm. And I was lucky enough to get to interview 558 young people and then also supportive adults. And the main barriers that came out were mental health was one, like everything that they've been through, the traumas, like the symptoms of trauma, like can come out in all types of ways when they're in class, trouble concentrating, intrusive thoughts, but then also like lack of belonging when they get to the college campuses in terms of feeling like other people have different backgrounds than them or different situations. And then like also not knowing how to navigate the institutions of how to like a lot of people in college have spoken the college speak since they were young and feel like they belong on campus, but not knowing how to navigate the campuses and the different departments within the institutions. And the supports were definitely supports related to resources, supportive adults, and really looking at those things. That's why we decided to do a three part approach, which is like direct mental health services for young people, as well as academic support with like an adult that can help them with resources and everything. And then also trainings. We provide trainings to parents and caregivers and social workers about trauma-informed care and mental health. So some of it's like more macro, like impacting the system. And then there's also direct supports to the students themselves.
Mm-hmm. And that is so awesome, because it's like they have that ongoing support, like you've mentioned, and it's like you're not leaving them once they leave. Kind of, I love that. And another thing that I admire about Inspiring Futures is the fact that you all don't require insurance or have strict criteria for enrollment. Can you talk a little bit more about the decision behind that, how it works, and how that's also helped you all?
Yes. So we are funded all by philanthropy right now. And part of that was because it's very hard to credential with health insurance companies. And that's a process we've been navigating for over a year. And so we were lucky that we were able to get philanthropic support to get us started, but we are going to be accepting health insurances in the near future. I could talk more about that process as well, but that would be to like diversify our revenue stream, because philanthropy can go up and down and you don't want to just rely on that. But we really want to like lower the barriers to access. And that's one of the reasons why people can't seek mental health services, is because they don't have health insurance, or their copayment's too high, or it's hard to figure out what therapists take your mental health insurance. So we wanted it to be easy to access, especially because a lot of our young people are in homeless shelters or transitional living programs. But then when we are able to take health insurance, we still won't turn anyone away. Like, we still have philanthropic support. And then if they have health insurance that we're able to bill, that's when we would have that as well. But it wouldn't be, you know, changing our model at all.
Yeah. And so it has been a process. And I want to kind of stay there a bit, because to one, have such a powerful organization is amazing. And then another part of that is, like you kind of talked about, that philanthropic support that you all have. I want to talk about how you were able to get others on board with your vision to support financially.
Yeah. So I've been in the program space since I've started my career. And so I've never been in the fundraising space. So this was definitely like a learning experience. From the beginning, I just mass applied to a ton of grants. And I know that's like not the best way to do it, because people say relationships is what matters, but I didn't have any relationships or connections with any funders or organizations. So what I would do is I would look at other organizations in the space, pull up their tax documents to see who had donated to them, and then see if they accepted unsolicited proposals. And then I would send in a proposal, and I would do one a day. And then it took a year before we got our first yes. And that was like a really exciting thing for someone to say, yes, let's do this. And even then, it still wasn't enough to like keep going. So we started March of 2022. We got our first grant March of 2023. And then it was so wonderful that they did give us a grant, but it still wasn't enough to like for it to give salaries or anything. So I was also doing independent contracting on the side as like a therapist with other organizations. And then it was June of 2023 when we got a very significant grant that was like a 4-year grant. And that was enough to provide me a salary, which then let me devote all my time to Inspiring Futures. And if we hadn't gotten that grant at that time, I probably would have, you know, had to just turn this into like a side gig and then like go back to work full time. But it just was very good timing. And then now that we've been in the space for a little bit longer, we are starting to make relationships with other funders, and the people who are funding us are introducing us to other people. So now we're pivoting to, you know, really starting to build relationships and try and go after like multi-year grants and more intentional applying to grants. So that's kind of where we started and where we are now.
Yeah, that is so amazing. Talk about resourcefulness, persistence, a whole year, and then like not having those relationships. Okay, so many things. One, you mentioned that, so you started in 2022. And I want to talk about the fact that you kind of spoke on you didn't have those relationships when you were looking for funding or looking to start the organization. Were there any other challenges that you had during this time? And how did you kind of navigate those? Because I know for entrepreneurs listening, a lot of people are thinking, dang, a whole year and she still kept going. Like, how did you do that? And then what other challenges were there that you were able to successfully navigate?
Yeah, I mean, so even though I was working on this, I still had my full-time job and I was working for the city. So that is a challenge in itself because there's so many conflicts of interest where it was like you really had to be very careful in how you move or what you ask for, because when you work for the city, like there's very strict rules on that. So I had, you know, I was starting this in March, but I didn't leave my city job for almost like 7 months later. And then when I finally did leave, that's when I like dove straight into this and I was doing independent contracting as well. But I would say like just even the outreach of like unsolicited proposals, like figuring out how to do that. Because on one hand, I was sending out like mass emails and that didn't do anything. And then I was like calling people that had their numbers listed on their 990s. But then those were like personal numbers and I had people like hanging up on me or like telling me never call me again. But then it was kind of like figuring out, no, they had to like make sure that they accepted unsolicited proposals. And then, you know, if I could say like, hey, I saw you funded this organization, or some of it was also luck. But yeah, it was just like trying to figure out how to get in contact with people, who to talk to without being, and when you're not known and you don't have like any reputation, and you can't really speak on that much. That was probably the hardest part of like not overselling ourselves. And then like we did also start doing the work as well. So like with the few participants that we had, and we were all, you know, volunteers or independent contractors, being able to speak to, okay, this is what's working with the few people that we do have, and this is how we would like to scale it.
That's so good. Yeah. And what comes up for me when you were speaking just now is how you mentioned that conflict of interest, because doing this type of work, I think a lot of people can relate to. They're very close to the problem, whether it be they experienced it or they're working for an organization. So for a lot of people, it is natural to want to step out on their own and do something in their field that they're already in. So how did you make sure that you were careful about that process, but then also decided, hey, I'm going to do this on my own versus continue with an organization?
So with the city, I was working for the Mayor's Office of Community Mental Health. And so we were overseeing the mental health services of like the youth homeless shelters, of some of the schools, the drop-in centers. And so I had to make sure that I wasn't part of any of those programmatic decisions or meetings related to things that I wanted to do. And my boss was actually didn't include me in those meetings anyway, even though that was the most interesting part. I was like, I want to be part of this, or like, you know, welfare system. But she just, you know, was like, no, you focus on these other things. And then making sure that I intentionally don't ask a lot of questions about because the mayor's office has so many different projects. So just making sure that I don't pay attention to the things that are related to, you know, foster care or mental health related to the child welfare system.
Okay. Solid advice. Got it. And Vicky, so you've had a lot of success in just hearing your journey, of course. So how did you learn how to run a business?
That's a really good question. I don't think I fully know how to run a business, but I did like start messaging people on LinkedIn when I started, and I looked at other nonprofit founders and executive directors, and I would send them direct messages on LinkedIn and then ask for like 30 minutes of their time. And a lot of people were really kind and met with me and gave me all this advice about things that I didn't even know I had to start thinking about yet. And everyone had different perspectives. So that was one important thing, was connecting with other nonprofit leaders, trying to have conversations with them. There are things that I know I can't do that I've tried to do and I won't be able to. Like, it's just not something that I can devote time to learning. And one of those things is like accounting. I've never done the accounting. And at the very beginning, we got an accountant through Volunteer Match. And then we also had a volunteer through like Pace University. And now we did hire like a contracted accountant, but it's like, I did try and do like accounting for 3 weeks. And then I realized like, this is something that I'm not good at. I can't mm-hmm. learn. And I have other things that I need to focus on that it would be better to delegate this aspect. And then with like HR, we use a system that has HR built into it. Like it's like a software system. So I don't have to necessarily know like all HR stuff, but we also have like leaning on other people with other expertises, like someone on the board of directors is a lawyer. So he's like also our compliance officer. If we have any complaints related to staff members or any of our work or any subpoenas, like, so knowing that we could lean on him and just knowing, I think it's just important to know what you're good at and then also mm-hmm. what you can learn and then what just absolutely is out of your wheelhouse.
Yeah, that is so good and key, because for a lot of people, they waste that time on trying to figure out, especially when you're dealing for a lot of people with limited budget. So it's about how do I stay resourceful and then also still delegate the things that I need to delegate and focus on what I need to focus on as the visionary. So that's good that you were able to stay in that visionary role. Mm-hmm. Another thing that you've kind of talked about is we've talked about some of the challenges that you face. I want to talk about, of course, doing this is 2022. You've had to make some pretty big decisions, and I'm sure there have been some shifts in your business. So looking back, what have been some of the biggest changes that have happened in your business?
Yeah, absolutely. So when we started, we wanted to do like a group home that focused on college going culture. And mm-hmm. like my initial board of directors, they were my friends and they were all like, yes, let's do this. We just have to raise like a few $100,000. Mm-hmm. But then we realized that like, you can't just raise a few $100,000. Like, and it also with New York City, like those contracts for group homes only come out every 6 years. And usually they go to the same nonprofits every 6 years. So that's kind of like not an entrance for us. So then we said, okay, we'll do something that requires less capital and overhead. So we're like, we'll do mobile services like mental health and academic support. And we were saying, okay, but we'll have like a consortium of colleges so that we can, you know, work with young people in high school and then have these colleges that can offer resources to them as they start applying to colleges. But then when we started like talking to colleges, they were like, okay, but what's in it for us? And like, you don't even have a reputation. So it was kind of like, you know, that would use their resources and their personnel, but they weren't getting anything out of it. And then mm-hmm. someone was like, we have students right now in college that need this support. Like, can you support our students? So then we said that would be like, you know, reciprocal, that we could accept young people in high school or college anywhere on their journey. And then we would just utilize like general resources and the connections that we make along the way. And that's what our model ended up being.
Gotcha. And oftentimes it's not a no forever. Do you think any of those things are no forever, or they're not right now? We can't do that right now, but we may circle back in the future.
We might circle back in the future if like, you know, contracting opens up for some type of like out of home placement, but that would require so much overhead mm-hmm. and, you know, we'd have to be like very established and well known and have a lot of like resources to do something like that. I don't see that happening in the near future. And then the consortium of colleges, that's also like an idea, but that would limit now the people who we would be able to support, because a lot of our students are in college currently, and we do like the mm-hmm. model of like accepting young people at any point in their journey.
Gotcha. And Vicky, one of the things you kind of talked about earlier also was the fact that you all were waiting for a very long time to receive that New York State waiver to provide therapy sessions as a nonprofit. Can you talk more about this process and some of those challenges related to that?
Yeah. So most people don't know this. I didn't know this, but there mm-hmm. is a ban on nonprofits providing professional services in New York State. And professional services can be legal, they could be mental health, they could be acupuncture, anything that really requires a license. And so I wasn't aware of that because, like I said, my professional career has been in Los Angeles and that's not the rule out there. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't until, I mean, at first I was like, do we need any type of approval for this? And I did my research and we even like when we incorporated our nonprofit, we worked with a law clinic and no one flagged this. So I was like, okay, like I did email. I thought possibly we needed a waiver, but that department never got back to me. So I was like, okay, I think it's fine. And then when we started working to credential with health insurances, that's when one of the health insurance companies said, you know, where is your waiver? And then I was like, oh, that's so funny. I was looking into that like a year ago, but I didn't think we actually needed it. And then when I looked further into it, I realized, yeah, like because nonprofits are banned from providing professional services, if you're going to do that, you need to justify why your nonprofit's needed, show kind of like how you're qualified to do it, how you're uniquely positioned to do this. And that department is very small. And so I applied in January of this year. And then we didn't get a response until August. And then the response was just like, your articles of incorporation are missing this disclaimer. So, you know, we can't issue it at this time. So then when we looked at our articles of incorporation, we said, okay, we just have to amend those. So we went to file to amend the articles of incorporation. And they said, okay, but you can't amend this except for if you have approval from the attorney general. So then we were like, okay, like how do we get approval from an attorney general? And so then that's when we hired a law firm to help us. And we called a lot of law firms and they didn't know because it's just like such a weird rule.
Yeah. That's like
specific. But then we were able to get approval from the attorney general, amend the articles of incorporation, and then we were able to be issued the waiver. But then even then, that doesn't mean you can bill health insurances. There are over 12 health insurances in New York State. And you have to like approach each of those to get credentialed with those particular insurances. And then you have to figure out how to bill them if your clients have those insurances. So even though, you know, we can legally accept health insurances, we're only credentialed with a handful of companies and we haven't figured out how to actually bill them yet. I'd say we're probably a week or two away from doing our first billing. And I'm still trying to approach the other health insurance companies to try and get credentialed with them as well.
That is a lot. I swear, I did not know that until you and I were talking about it. And I said, oh my God, I did not know that. So like you mentioned, it's so much that you don't know, I think, in business. And a lot of times it's, you don't know until you have to go through it and hit that roadblock. So for you as a leader, like how did you deal with those challenging times? Because I'm sure it was frustrating for you. And how did you stay focused?
It was very frustrating. And it was also like worrisome because if we didn't get the waiver, hypothetically, they could say like, we can't operate because we're not licensed to even like provide mental health services, which is the bulk of our work, which also didn't necessarily make sense because all of us are licensed mental health professionals, but it's like we can provide those things in a private practice. We can provide that to other nonprofits that have contracts with the Department of Health, but just not in this specific nonprofit. So I was really worried that like we might have to shut down. But then I was like, you know, there's so many other things to focus on. There's so many other fires to put out. And I know that it's like a waiting game. So what can you do besides wait? So just trying to like talk to people and see if anyone had any advice or, you know, and I did talk to another nonprofit that was really big and I realized they were having a similar issue. And I'm like, wow, like I thought it was just because we are like not well known and we're small, but this was like a huge organization. And they were like, yeah, like this is dealing with this a nightmare and a lot of people go through it.
Well, glad that you went through it. And of course, it's not glad that you got through it. And of course, excited that, you know, you're going to be approaching this in about a week. And like I mentioned, I didn't know about that also until we were at Hey Ground. I would love to talk about, you kind of spoke on how you were reaching out to other organizations and just having that resource and support. I think that is really key in entrepreneurship. So you are a part of Communitas America. I want to talk about the role that Communitas has helped in helping you overcome these challenges, whether that meant that support when you're navigating these requirement process or just like team members. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, Communitas has been wonderful, especially for like letting us use the space. To have a space to meet and meet young people, see people for therapy or for, you know, meetings is so important. Not everyone likes virtual therapy. It's been, and it gives us like credibility to say, yeah, we have a space in Harlem that we go to. So it definitely gives credibility. It gives a space to collaborate. And then like also the connections with other alumni has been awesome. Like there are so many other organizations that are doing similar work or adjacent work that we're able to partner with or even just like brainstorm. So I think like having that community aspect has been very helpful as well.
Yeah. And Vicky, you talk about the community aspect and also like partnerships, and you are very resourceful. I want to just talk about how for a lot of entrepreneurs, they may be experiencing those times where they feel like they don't have that support or they don't know how to reach out to people or they don't want to seem like they're so needy. So for you, how do you manage relationships and also having the courage to reach out to people, to be resourceful, to seek out opportunities?
Yeah, that's a really hard thing. And I definitely struggle with that too, especially like in the very beginning when we didn't have funding, where I didn't even have a salary. It was kind of like, how can we go to someone and ask a question when they're going to say like, but what, like, what are you even doing? Or like, are you even a thing? Or so that was like kind of, and then it was like, my wife is very confident and she is in tech sales. And she's like, no, you need to say like, you have this amazing thing. And these are all the things you can offer. And I'm like, okay, but then you have to hope that they're not going to take us up on like all these offers because our capacity is very limited. So it's like finding that balance of like, you don't have it figured out, but you have something. And it's like, even though you don't, like everyone has questions and it's a journey, but it doesn't make you less legitimate. So it's, I think it's really like an internal dialogue. It's like probably the other people aren't even thinking that. But I always run on like the anxious side and then knowing how to like balance that out.
Yeah, that is so good. It's so good. That's a good thing about you have someone with sales background. That's something I'm like, oh, I need to do more of learning the sales part of it. But you have to do it because otherwise you won't grow. And you've been able to do some amazing things. So speaking of growth, another thing we talked about earlier is your team. And you mentioned how a lot of your team also have similar or lived experience in this space. How do you find your team or contract therapist specialists and the like? And can you kind of talk about the system behind this?
Yeah. So to find mental health practitioners in New York City is very difficult. There's a shortage of social workers for sure. And then you're competing with like very big organizations and there's such a high demand, mostly because social workers, you know, a lot of them are going into private practice or they're getting burned out. Same with teachers. So I don't think it's just like posting a job opportunity. You could try and do that, but that generally hasn't worked for me. And so our first mental health therapist was actually myself. I was doing the therapy work. And then it was like, I can only see so many clients at once. And then I knew someone else like that in my personal life that was just about to graduate from social work school. And she partnered with me and she's like, okay, yeah, like I see your vision. Let's do this. And then when we were looking for another mental health therapist, we actually did send out like a blast through the Department of Labor, which also was a connection through Communitas. And we were lucky that like we did find a really qualified therapist who's still with us. And then after that, we had a lot of Spanish speaking clients and I was doing some Spanish speaking therapy, but I'm not a native fluent Spanish speaker. So I was like, we need to find a Spanish speaking therapist ASAP. So again, I went back to LinkedIn and I was directly messaging like Spanish speaking therapists. And I was like, I have this opportunity for you. What do you think? And I did get someone that was interested. And then now like the other people who work with us, they're through connections. So like our first therapist recommended her past coworker and now she's on board with us. And then our new coordinator is someone I used to work with at a past job. So it's like, as you go through the work, as long as you're like trying to be as best of a workplace as you can for people and trying to like highlight the mission and trying to listen to like what people are looking for in a workplace. Hopefully all the recent hires we have been word of mouth. Even our last new hire over the summer, like that was a recommendation from a board member. And that's been more successful than I have put in like things on Indeed and ZipRecruiter that didn't really yield candidates, or even LinkedIn job postings that didn't really yield candidates.
Yeah, that's so good. And And even for people listening, so what advice would you give to them in terms of how do you oversee the work of the contractors or the people that you're working with?
Yes. So I think for contractors and for full-time employees, because we have both, and I think like it's very different. Contractors, like you can't really tell them anything in terms of like scheduling or like what they actually will be doing at a certain time. It's like they need to independently own their work. And like, just for me, I make sure that I'm like, you can bill for this work. Like the way you get paid is to produce this work every 2 weeks. And if you find the right people with the motivation, that just kind of, and then also like inviting them to all of the staff meetings and have an open door policy for like if they ever want to talk or have advice, but you just can't mandate anything. And then for the full-time employees, I think we are still like, we're moving from a startup to trying to scale or have like systems in place. And that is a transition because it's like, I have been doing most of all of the admin stuff for so long. And it's like being able to delegate and trust other people to run things in their wheelhouse and figuring out who can do what without oversight. So that's something we're still navigating for sure.
Yeah. Letting go of those reins, I definitely understand. And speaking of scaling, I would love to talk about how you are managing, you know, the daily operations, but still making that time to continue to fundraise, continue to go after a grant.
Yeah. So I am really trying to move out of the direct service space. I still maintain a caseload of young people I see for therapy every week. And my goal is to like, as people close their cases or they stop therapy, like I don't replace those people with new clients. I really want to move into like supervising the therapist and focusing on fundraising and partnerships. And so that's my goal because it's a very different skill set and to be like a direct clinical therapist versus someone that's trying to run the organization. And it's very like time intensive to see a direct caseload, like a caseload of young people. Yeah. So I'm trying to really figure out my time, how to delegate different things. And then with the coordinator role, like that's such a fluid role. So like even putting her into some of the operations of like the outreach or when we get new inquiries, like trying to create workflows so that I might never have to touch that client at all or like getting them into the system at all.
Gotcha. And then when it comes to going after grants and things like that, how are you approaching this process in terms of continued funding?
Yes. So we, you know, I'm not applying to one grant a day anymore, but I am trying to not miss opportunities. If I do see things that we qualify for, I definitely do apply for them. But then I am talking to like our current funders to see if they have any connections or people they think that I should be applying to. We were really lucky that the second grant that we got, that person who's in charge of that funding has connected us with even like someone that navigates like fundraising and has given me recommendations. And then our first year of funding was mostly through accelerators. And that's like one-time fundraising, but one-time funding, but it comes with like coaching and, you know, communities and training. So really like tapping into those networks as well, if they have any ideas. And I'm really trying to go after like multi-year funding at this point so that we don't have to re-raise the budget every year.
Yes, that's right. And even when you're going through this process, I love that you kind of talked about in the beginning, you were doing a lot of everyday grants. So now it's like even getting more strategic. Were you finding any common themes or challenges when you were applying to these grants or even now?
I think like just knowing that like if a grant is for $1,000 versus $50,000, like usually the work to apply to it is exactly the same. In fact, the $1,000 grant might ask for more work than the $50,000 grant. So like not being shying away from the money amount, but more so what the process is. And then I like for us, we do, you know, academics and then also mental health and then also like young people system involvement. So looking for like grants that are in any of those categories and shifting the language of the applications based on what they care about, because there's some grants that like we don't fund mental health services. So it's like, okay, so then let's talk about our academic support or the trainings that we provide and just knowing the actual funder. You can have like some language that you want to put into the grant, but knowing that you have to like tweak it when you write it.
Mm, That's a great tip. And that's great advice. And just like learning how to navigate that. And so Vicky, being that you've been in this space for years, and then also now having a business, what access to identifiable people or resource do you wish you had that you've not been able to obtain yet? And what would you say is the most urgent need of Inspiring Futures?
I think our most urgent need is to just figure out how to create systems. We are still operating as like very grassroots, where everything is like manually inputted, and everything is individualized. So we are working on like creating curriculums and like, you know, this is the process and this is the workflow. And it's like, we've been doing the work for a few years, but then like, how do we put it down on paper so that if I was to step out tomorrow, someone else could come in and do the same exact mm-hmm. thing, but not losing our like, you know, unique touch, but we still care about the work, but we also, it can be replicated and we can step in and out and it would still be running appropriately.
Yeah. And I think most businesses would want that. It's like, this is, mm-hmm. Allowing me to step away and continue to be the visionary. And when you think about resources in terms of those who are the holders of maybe capital or actual things that you need to propel the business forward, what would you say are those things that are needed in order to change the current space in this industry?
Yeah, I think that like funders really should accept unsolicited proposals. Like there are so many funders that are invite only, like mm-hmm. I would say the majority. So you spend so much time like looking at all these amazing funders and you're like, but I don't have any introductions to them. They don't know who I am. And like, I can't send them an email. I can't call them. So it's like, yeah, I think like there should be like, just like an openness to like look for, and they're like, well, we want them to be recommended by people, or we want to, you know, see their reputation first, or we want to invite them only. But you're missing out on a lot of businesses and organizations by doing that, because the same people know the same people. And then that's like ignoring all the new emerging ones. And maybe that's by design, but I really think that there shouldn't be like no unsolicited proposals, like mm-hmm. at all. Like it should just be like, and I understand they'd probably get thousands of proposals, but there has to be like some way to contact these people.
Yeah. Yes, certainly. And you mentioned that even in some of the programs that you've been in, you've been able to lean on the resources within those programs. So I would love it if you could talk about your approach, or how even being in these fellowships and programs have allowed you to do that. So you've been in fellowships such as Camelback Ventures, the Get Help Social Justice Accelerator, and the EGF Accelerator. So how are you leaning on them for continued support or resources?
Yeah, so Camelback was amazing, and they have a like portal where like all of us can upload any, like we write down any funding we have gotten from who, and then like we can see which people have gotten funding from which foundations, and we can ask like other alumni for like intros to the organization, like to the foundation. It's mm-hmm. like, okay, like I'm looking at them too, like do you have a contact over there? So you might be able to get a warm intro. The Urban Justice Center Social Justice Accelerator, that's the one I'm in right now. Mm-hmm. They've been amazing as well, because like they have a podcast and they just like are good thought partners. And they helped us with some of the like initial barriers when we had trouble like with our own staff getting health insurance. Like we worked out an agreement with them. So they really helped us overcome some hurdles. And then we're even like part of the small grant community through New Yorkers for Children. And so mm-hmm. that's like a lot of small nonprofits working in the child welfare space. And we come together every other month and we're able to share like experiences. So I think like, yeah, like asking other people for introductions has been really helpful, and other people offering to make introductions.
Yeah, that's the part right there. And of course, how are you continuing to lean on Communitas America as you continue to grow and develop?
Yes, absolutely. So we still use Communitas America as our like landing space. Like we come here to work 2 times a week. We sometimes see clients here as well. We're able to ask some of the staff at Communitas if we have any questions regarding like legal stuff or partnerships to be thought partners. And then like knowing the other entrepreneurs in the space, like being able to think through different issues. That's ways that we plan to continue to use Communitas.
Yeah, I love that. I love the fact that the power of being in community in terms of having other entrepreneurs around you who kind of understand, because I oftentimes feel like when you're in spaces where people aren't entrepreneurs, maybe it's family or friends, they don't understand the daily, the things that you go through on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. So, and Vicky, as you grow, how are you continuing to keep a pulse on what's going on in the community? So making sure that you're not out of touch or losing that touch with the community.
Yes, absolutely. So we're really working on it, like incorporating young people, especially young people who've gone through our program, into our programming decisions. Mm-hmm. Over the summer, we had an internship for a young person that was paid. She was able to give us advice on our programs and run our social media and do our newsletter. And she said she really enjoyed that internship. And then we did a listening campaign with all of our participants where we asked them, like, what was their advice? What were some of the strengths of our program? What did they want to see? And then implementing their advice as well. When we hire a new staff, we always have a program participant participate in the interview to make sure that they approve of the person that we're about to hire, because they're the ones that like would know the best if they would be a good fit or not.
Yeah.
And then we're looking at maybe putting a young person on our board of directors so that they could be part of like the decision-making process. And just, yeah, looking at all the ways that we want, like, that everyone's voices is heard.
That is beautiful. Putting the young person on the board, that is beautiful. Talk about doing things differently. Mm-hmm. I am definitely inspired. So also, like, you've been doing this, as you mentioned, since 2022. And then you've been in this space for years. I want to talk about the impact of the work that you are doing. Do you have any examples of stories that you just seen such a transformation and was just so moved by? I'm pretty sure you are almost daily, but anything that sticks out?
Yes. I think it's important to look at like everyone's different definitions of success, and like mm-hmm. success looks different for every person. We have like had your traditional success stories where you have like someone that's in college and then they've graduated and gotten a job in their dream space, and now they're able to live on their own. They got a pet, and they're just like thriving in the workspace. That's like a very traditional definition. But then we've had young people that, you know, were in a homeless shelter, that left an abusive relationship, that were able to stay out of the hospital and then obtain housing and then enroll in a GED program. And that was a success, even though it wouldn't look like it to other people, or like it's not on their radar. And then we've had young people that, you know, they were here and they were in a bad situation. They might have been in a trafficking situation. They were also in abusive situations. And then they were able to leave the state. We helped them relocate and connect to resources in their new state, make sure that they had a place to stay, make sure that they were connected to, you know, someone to help them navigate like housing and education. And then we closed their case, which might also not look like a traditional success story, but it's a success for them because they're safe now and this wasn't going to work out for them out here.
Yeah, that is beautiful. Truly amazing stories. And speaking of, like you mentioned, the GED program, and even earlier we talked about the percentage of graduation rates historically. Can you talk a little bit about how you've seen the graduation rates for System Evolve you've changed since you started Inspiring Futures?
Sure. So I can't speak to like the system itself. Even the data that came out from City with that graduation statistic, it was like after the fact, it was like these were in the past decade from like 2011 to 2021. And it was like those statistics are very hidden. But yeah. In our program, we've seen last year over 90% of the people who were enrolled in school moved to the next grade or graduated. And then of the students who were not in school, we were able to start the enrollment of 30 of those students and fully enroll 10% of those students. So our statistics within the program are definitely higher than the general landscape. And then hopefully we'll be able to use those cases to see like, you know, trends and stuff like that.
Yeah. And I'm so glad that you make that distinction, because it also shows how a lot of times these stats are years behind and we're doing this work right now. So your program is making this type of impact. Go, Vicky. Vicky said, for us, we're doing this. I love it. And then, so of course, with focusing on community, and I'm sure there are those challenges as well. So what have you seen have been some of the most challenging aspects of engaging with the community whom you serve?
I think one challenging aspect is sometimes we get referrals from people that they want the young person to be in therapy, but the young person is not bought in. Mm. It might be like a criteria of their housing, or it might be something that's recommended to them by the courts, but they don't want it. So really trying to figure out how to engage that young person, see if it's the right time for them, and then give them alternate options. It's not the right time for them, knowing that all the services are voluntary and we never want to like force someone to participate in something that they don't want to do. And then for young people that do want the services and stay with us, I think the hardest thing that we've seen is housing. There are so many young people that they either owe a ton of rental arrears and they're facing eviction, or they're in unstable housing and they can't find an apartment, or they can't find another shelter to stay in. We had a young person over the summer who she was asked to leave her transitional housing. And then we called every youth homeless shelter in the city for like 2 weeks, and none of them had any space the whole time. So we weren't able to find housing for her, and she ended up going with a relative in another state. But I think like housing is definitely a pressing issue for these young people. And especially if you, how can you focus on like school or on job searching if you don't know where you're going to sleep at
night? Right. Exactly. And so how would you advise, or you talked about the different options that you give because you don't want to feel, want someone to feel forced. And for other entrepreneurs who might be dealing with those challenges when they're doing the work for a community, how would you advise they deal with those setbacks or challenges?
I think they need to be very realistic with like the referral sources or the people that they're partnering with to say like, this is realistically what we would like to do. But it depends on, you know, who we're partnering with and like what's going on at the time in the community and what the individual participants want. So knowing that it can pivot and, you know, making sure that everyone's on the same page. And when you said like, how do you stay like close to the community or make sure that their voices are heard? Like, you're not doing things that no one has agreed to or like that no one has given input on. You can't just like execute an idea without doing like a needs assessment or figuring out if it's something that is actually needed. So really being flexible and like just pivoting if you need to.
Solid advice. And Vicky, this has been amazing. I do want to know, what are you most excited about for Next for Inspiring Futures, or some of the things that are coming up?
I'm very excited for this upcoming year. We did just like grow our team. So now we have 4 full-time staff members and they're amazing people. Yeah. And like the program we're going to be able to create and the way that we're about to be able to enroll more young people because we have more capacity and really seeing like how we can do this on a bigger scale. I'm very excited for that.
I'm excited. And that is a big deal. New full-time, new programming, all big deal things. Mm-hmm. And finally, what advice would you give to entrepreneurs who are passionate about making an impact and empowering youth and breaking down barriers, but they're just starting out?
I would say definitely like know what your North Star is and like follow that. And there are people that are going to say that's stupid, or there's already someone doing that, or why are you going to do it that way? And it's like knowing what advice makes sense and then what advice is just like, okay, they're just not like understanding my vision, or they're just not like really seeing where I'm going. But like, you don't need to take everyone's advice because everyone gives conflicting advice, and knowing like what is important to you. And I'd say that's, and there are going to be like really good days with a lot of successes, and there's going to be like days where you're just like, why am I even doing this? But just being able to stay like kind of consistent. And even if you just move a little bit forward in that day, like just like know where you're going, or just to keep trying.
Valid advice. And Vicky, where can people find you, support you, and all the great things?
Yes. So they could check out our website. On the website, they have a link that they could sign up for our newsletter. We also have volunteer opportunities. They could also, if they want to be interested in being on the board of directors, if they want to check out some of our success stories, I think our website is a great place to start. And then if they have young people that they want to refer to our programs, we have a link that we could send out where anyone can just refer young people that they think could benefit.
Beautiful. Vicky, thank you so much for the work that you are doing. And also thank you so much for sharing your story, your insights on Communitas of New York.
Thank you, Monique. Thank you so much for interviewing me. And I really appreciate this conversation.
Visit our website for more information about this and all of our shows. You can find that in the show notes. Thank you for listening and see you soon. My name is Monique T. Marshall, and this is Communitas of New York. Season 1 is produced by Simone Jung and David Michael D. Gregoria.